rise. The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, this is a busy day in court. We had a lot of students for the last argument. Looks like we have a full house again. My notes tell me that the students from Prairie du Chien High School are here, and if they are, would they stand, please? Oh, wow. You have quite a group. You may be seated. Well, we like to have the students come to court to see what it's like to have a matter presented to the Supreme Court and to have good arguments from counsel that they can hear and learn about. They are here with the program we operate with the State Bar called Court with Class, so they know a little bit about the case that you all are going to argue for us in a few minutes. If you can stay, students, after this argument, Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who sits on my right, will come down and chat with you a little bit about procedures in the Supreme Court. And everyone, in addition to the students who would like to come and hear what she has to say, are certainly welcome to do so. And it will commence right after this argument. So if you can stay, please do. With those preliminaries, I'll call our second case. Adams Outdoor Advertising versus City of Madison. Are you prepared to proceed?
I am.
Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Eric McLeod, and along with my colleagues Jeff Ricotterin and Joseph Dietrich, I represent Adams Outdoor Advertising Limited Partnership, the petitioner before this court, and the plaintiff in the courts below. This case presents a simple but very important question arising under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Specifically, does government action that deprives a property owner of the pre-existing, legally non-conforming use of land amount to a constructive taking of that interest?
Counsel, the property can still be used to host a billboard, correct?
The plot of land that Adams owns does, in fact, continue to display an east-facing sign that can be used for advertising. That's correct. And ultimately, the question in this case is, for purposes of constructive takings analysis, what is the proper definition of the property interest that has been taken?
And right, and before we get to the denominator question, perhaps we could focus on the definition of the property right that you're asserting, which is, it appears to be, the right to be seen from the freeway.
I think, and that's the argument that the city has made, that what we are seeking is recognition of a right to be seen. I think that is a mischaracterization of the issue that's presented in this case. The issue that's been presented in this case is whether Adams has the right to continue a pre-existing use of its property, the sole purpose of which is to display advertising and be seen. The unique facts of this case happen to involve advertising, and advertising necessarily, certainly with outdoor billboards, necessarily requires that the use be seen. But the principle involved in this case centers on the right of a property owner to continue a pre-existing use of property in the face of government interference with that use.
If, in fact, the billboard had been raised, that would require the city's permission. Is that something that people just didn't bother with here, or?
Well, actually, Your Honor,
if it's outside the record, don't answer my question.
Well, what I can say as part of the record is that after the filing of this lawsuit, the case was stayed for a year, which is certainly a matter of a record, for the purpose of finding a resolution to that very question.
Okay, all right.
And it's because the use is a legal nonconforming use, cannot be moved, cannot be raised,
right,
that prevents Adams from mitigating against the impact that has been caused by the building of the bridge.
Thank you.
Council, the AMICUS, the Outdoor Advertising Association of Wisconsin, took a different tack in its argument, and in the course of your argument, wherever appropriate, I'd like to get your thoughts on whether you agree with the argument that's being made there, that the property is really the billboard permit, which under tax law is real property, and that's where the constructive takings occurred.
The permit to display the billboard is certainly a separate property interest that could be the subject of takings analysis in this case. I guess I don't disagree with the amicus brief in that respect, because they ultimately are advocating for the same result as we are, but I think it's a distinction without a difference, because the question ultimately is whether or not we're able to maintain and use that west-facing sign in light of the construction of the bridge. The city hasn't dispossessed us of our license. In fact, the city treats both sign faces as separate economic units by virtue of the fact that they have licensed both sign faces separately, and that's a critical piece of our analysis here. Certainly that license could stand for its own separate property interest that could be the subject of takings analysis, and in fact the Maxey case of this court related to a theater license that had been withdrawn, and this court recognized in that case that property interest could be the subject of a takings claim.
Does it matter here that the license or permit has not been withdrawn or revoked by the city?
In our opinion, it does not matter, because ultimately the question boils down to how to define the interest, and if we define the interest as the sign face, the west-facing sign, there's a stipulation in the case that sign has been obscured 100%, and there's no further beneficial use of that sign as a result. The issue in this case boils down to how to properly define the interest that is the subject of takings analysis. And to address the specific question that we're raising in this case, namely, can a municipality prohibit a pre-existing use through the enactment or through some sort of government action? We know what the answer to that question is in the context of zoning. Now, the city argues that this right is only protected within the context of the city's enactment of a zoning ordinance. But certainly within that context, the city cannot take some action to dispossess us of our right to display the west-facing sign. And as we've stated in our briefs, the city's position in this case is akin to a city ordinance prohibiting double-sided billboards, directing us to remove the west-facing sign and saying there's been no taking because you can continue to display the east-facing building. Certainly the city knows it can't take that position.
Yeah, so let's look at it from this perspective. Certainly the highway could be rerouted, and you would lose viewership just as surely as the bridge having been built. So what is the philosophical distinction that makes one a taking and the other not? And I presume that you would agree that rerouting the freeway would not constitute a taking.
That's correct. Based on those limited facts, Your Honor, the question boils down to, and this is the subject of Murr, a case recently decided by the United States Supreme Court, and the subject of briefing in this case, the question boils down to what is a reasonable, objective, reasonable expectation on the part of a property owner as to the future use of its property. What does a reasonable property owner expect how the law will treat its property interest? It is theoretically possible, and in fact the city specifically uses that term, theoretically possible, that the highway could be rerouted. The question is whether or not that's a reasonable expectation. When Adams bought this billboard in 2007, it did so based on the then current state of affairs, one of which is that the billboard sits on the north side of the West Beltline Highway. It would be unreasonable, we would submit, that there would be any expectation that Beltline would be closed, that it would be rerouted. Those are all issues that depend on the specific facts and circumstances affecting that particular piece of property. So we could talk about theoretical changes that could have a dramatically negative impact on this property. The question is whether those are reasonable to expect could occur that could have that kind of an impact. It is unreasonable to expect that the government would take certain action that would completely obliterate the west-facing sign or either side of the billboard. And principally, that's because the law protects that continued use. The basic foundation of our position in this case, Your Honor, is not just zoning law, non-conforming use law that arises in the context of zoning law, but the fundamental constitutional principle that undergirds all of that, which is private property rights protected by the Constitution. If I'm Adams in 2007 buying this billboard, I can identify that it has two faces. Each of those faces pre-exists the city's ordinance that prohibits billboards. And I know the law protects my ability to maintain both those sign faces going forward. That's the reasonable expectation that Adams had and any property owner would have.
And you can still do that.
The billboard is still there, Your Honor. There's no
right.
dispute about that.
You can still maintain it. You can still put whatever advertising you want on it. It's just that nobody's going to see it.
Well, nobody will buy advertising on the sign that faces west, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's a stipulated fact
right.
in the record
in
here.
The record.
And that goes to the question, then, of whether or not there has been a taking. If we recognize the existence of that separate property interest, the west-facing sign, the question then is, and this is an articulation of the law of longstanding, both by this court and the U.S. Supreme Court, and that is, has all or substantially all of the economic use of that property been destroyed? And if it has, that constitutes a constructive taking. That issue is not in dispute in this case, we would submit, because the city has stipulated to the fact that the bridge does obscure the view of the west-facing sign completely.
Right. So that part seems to be pretty well set. So perhaps you could tell me how you would distinguish Randall. So Randall says, although plaintiffs may sustain consequential damages insofar as the street improvement will somewhat obstruct or interfere with ingress and egress and the view to and from their land to the vehicular traveled portion of the street, that is not a taking of private property for public use. How would you distinguish that?
Very simply, Your Honor, and that is that, and there are two main parts of this. First, Randall involved a future prospective use of property. If one reads that case carefully, one will note that, in fact, there was no use of that property. It was a vacant lot, and the owner had some future intention to build an apartment or other structure on that property. That's similar to Zeeley and other cases which are common in takings analysis, which is, have my future or prospective interests in the use of this property been affected? Here we've got a pre-existing use, a use that already exists.
let's work this through in the timeline. So Randall applies to situations where there's no current use, and then we move along the timeline, you engage in a use, let's say a billboard. Are you saying then that at that point the right to be seen becomes vested?
It is the right to maintain and continue with that pre-existing use. In this case, and I want to get back to Randall in a second, but in this case, the sole purpose of that use and the continuation of that use that has been vested is to display advertising which must be seen. So the question then is, has the government action that is being challenged here as a taking, does that deprive us of that particular interest in this case? In Randall, even if there had been a building that had already existed on the lot that Randall owned, there were no facts in that case that suggested a purpose, let alone a sole purpose, was to be viewed from the street. Anytime the government takes some action, certainly it could have an impact like that, and there may be consequential damages as the court referred to in Randall. But the question there would be, did the impact, did the effect of that government improvement on Wisconsin Street in Milwaukee deprive Randall of all or substantially all of the beneficial use of that property? You would have to do that analysis, and it would be difficult to conclude that a structure on the sidewalk that had some small obstruction of the view would satisfy that very demanding standard. In this case, we easily satisfy that standard.
All right. So what we're looking at then is the use being a reasonable investment-based expectation, right? And that's how you're defining the property rights.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So in this circumstance, the bridge gets built. Was this built entirely on then existing public right-of-way?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I'm not sure that it certainly was not built on Adams' property.
Right. But you don't know if they had to engage in any other eminent domain proceedings to obtain land upon which to build this bridge?
There isn't anything in the record that would answer that question.
All right. So let's assume that it was all built on then existing right-of-way. How does that affect your analysis about reasonable investment-based expectations? Because if it's all on existing public right-of-way, then, you know, anybody who buys next to a freeway knows there could be more construction that occurs in that right-of-way.
And the question is whether it's reasonable to expect that a bridge would be built immediately in front of and completely obscure that pre-existing use.
Or some structure of some kind.
We would have to look at the specific facts of a different case involving a different structure and the impact that had on this particular pre-existing use. I don't think we could fairly say we had any expectation that there would never be any other use of adjacent property. The question then becomes whether it's reasonable for us to expect that adjacent property would be used for this particular purpose and that it would be such that it would completely obscure and destroy the value of that west-facing sign. And I'd like to refer specifically to this court's decision in a case called Domkaler against the City of Milwaukee. It's a case from 1904, and it was referenced in this court's more recent decision, EL Enterprises from 2010. And the question there involved whether or not specific government action involved resulted in the mere consequential damage to a property owner for which a takings claim would not lie. And this court referenced Domkaler, again, a case from 1904, noting, this is a quote from Domkaler, a city might so build a bridge or open a street or excavate a canal along or upon a lot, only appropriating a small portion of it or perhaps none of the land itself, and yet entirely destroy the value of the property for all purposes. That's this court's recognition that the specific action that's been taken here could result in the complete destruction of a protectable property interest and would give rise to a claim for constructive taking.
So let's say you are writing the opinion that will eventually come out. Do you need to write that the right to see, that you have a property interest in the right to see the billboard?
Do we have a property interest in the right to see a billboard? Mm-hmm. I think that is the effect of the decision that, if you were asking me what decision this court should write, that would be the effect of the decision the court should write, which again is that a legal non-conforming use, a pre-existing use, which is a vested property interest, mm-hmm. is protectable under the takings clause from government action which destroys all or substantially all of the beneficial use of that property. In the case of a billboard, the destruction of the use is the destruction of the view. In a different case, the harm or the manner in which the government action has deprived the property owner of its interest in that use may be different. So the facts of this case necessarily require that result, Your Honor, but the central legal principle is frankly not an entirely novel one. It is one that is rooted in decades of law from this court, in which this court has recognized that pre-existing legal nonconforming uses of property are protected from government interference. Back as far as the building height cases in 1923, the Desjardins case from the 50s, these are cases, and Desjardins was not a zoning ordinance per se, which is an important distinction. The rights that exist that protect pre-existing legal nonconforming uses are not merely protected in the context of zoning. That those rights, vested rights protected by the Constitution, are protected regardless of the nature of the government action. The second question always must be whether what has been destroyed is all or substantially all of the beneficial interest in that property interest.
Suppose this had not been the government in the bridge, but suppose it had been another property owner and it put up some kind of structure that prevented the billboard from being seen. Does that change this case?
It does, for the very important reason that we would not have a takings claim against a private party.
What would you would you have any claim?
Yeah, we would,
the
Your
private?
Honor.
What kind of claim would you have?
We would have a claim for a private nuisance, and in fact, that's a claim we sought to bring, but we're reminded that such a claim may not lie against the government, with the exception of very unique circumstances. But this harkens back to the Pravi Moretti case.
That's what I was looking at.
Thank you.
1982.
Correct.
I wrote it.
I'm well aware of that, Your Honor. That's why I was ready to recite it to you.
I am, too.
And in that case, this court recognized a very important principle, which is, does the impact of construction on neighboring property that impacts my property, there may be no right to a view broadly understood, but there is a right to be free from private nuisance that occurs on neighboring property.
But where it's the government's action that is affecting the property interests, the real underlying issue is who bears the cost of the public improvement. Should it be borne by the public as a whole, or should it be borne by one property owner? Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and that's a very important principle in the context of regulatory takings, constructive takings analysis. And the city is certainly free to build a bridge in the location that it built the bridge. We weren't legally able to stop it. We weren't able to bring a private nuisance claim against the city ultimately. But that public work of building that bridge had a specific private impact on Adams that should not be borne solely by Adams. If the city wishes to build a bridge that has that sort of dramatic impact on private property rights, then the city should step up and say, well, we're going to need to compensate Adams for that harm, or alternatively could have allowed Adams, in the absence of the legal nonconforming use status that prevented us from moving or raising the height of the sign, saying we'll fix the problem, we'll allow you a remedy to the problem by virtue of the fact that we built this bridge in front of your sign by allowing us to move the sign, raise the sign, a remedy that was not available to us. It goes back to the first statement we made in our brief, which is we have a right, but we have no remedy. And
I want to go back to the first statement you made in oral argument, if I may, before your time is out. And the first statement dealt with how to define the property right that's being asserted here as having been taken. And so I want to focus on how that threshold question, I think. You're not claiming here, are you, that you have a property interest in the permit? I didn't see it in your complaint. I didn't see the word permit in your brief, so I didn't think you were claiming that.
I think we do have a property interest in the permit, but I don't think that the property interest in the permit has been specifically taken in this case. The nature of the takings claim is the obstruction of the sign face.
Yes, indeed. I think I didn't artfully enough frame my question. You're not claiming that in this case, that the property that you want compensation for is the permit. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So you're not claiming that the income that you earn by based on the permit, you're not claiming that's a concern for us, right?
That is a concern, Your Honor.
All right.
That's different
than your answer to Justice Bradley's question.
Maybe I misunderstood the question. Certainly, as in terms of measuring the damages or the impact or the value of that interest, whether you identify the value as flowing from the permit in the display of that sign, or you just recognize the sign exists and it's going to continue to be used for advertising and it will generate a certain amount of revenue through the display of advertising, that number tied to the permit or tied to the sign face will be the same issue. So
if I may return then to my question, and that is, so I don't think in looking through your first amended verified complaint, I mean, the word petition isn't mentioned. It's not mentioned in your brief. So I didn't take that as the definition of the property here at issue that you're asserting is being taken. Am I correct?
That's correct. We did not define it that way.
But you started from the very get-go about taking issue with the way the opposing counsel has defined the property being taken. And as I say, I think this is the threshold. As I understand it, you are saying that it's a vested right in the continuation of a pre-existing use, which was the use to be seen, having the sign being seen. Is that correct?
That's
correct?
The ultimate conclusion. It's to continue to display the west-facing sign.
So that
the
it can be seen.
The sole purpose of which is to be seen. That's correct.
That's right. That's right. So why isn't it essentially the way that your opposing counsel also frames the property right that you're asserting is being taken? That the property right is the right to be seen.
Because I think that is not an essential element of the underlying legal principle that we are asserting here. That is a consequence of the application of that principle in this case, which is, in this case, the use that we're seeking to protect
is the right to be seen.
It's the display of the billboard, which is to be seen, and I'm not trying to suggest that our ability to be seen is not a critical piece of it, but it's a critical piece of it by virtue of the specific use here, not because we're seeking to establish a right to be seen. Pravi Moretti would and its progeny would say, no, we don't have a general right to be seen, but we do have property rights in the protection of pre-existing legal nonconforming uses.
As set forth in your issue, is essentially, that is issue number one, the right not to have the sign be obstructed. That's what you said. Whether a municipality's complete obstruction of a property owner. That's the way you phrase that, the right not to have it obstructed.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see that my red light is on.
It is.
So I will conclude with that. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Evan Tenebruso, Amanda Kaiser, and I represent the City of Madison. The lower courts got this case right. There is no right to be seen, and when doing the takings analysis, the parcel must be viewed as a whole. We have certainty in the law on both of those issues, and need to retain that certainty.
Counsel, what about the arguments made in the amicus brief, which is that the permit itself is real property, and that is the property interest here, and while it hasn't been revoked, It has effectively been taken because there is no economically productive use of the property, i.e. the billboard permit left because of the construction of the bridge.
Thank you, Justice Bradley. I appreciate that question. Those arguments in the amicus brief also struck me for a couple of reasons. One, the case was not framed that way from the get-go. It was not alleged that way in the complaint or in the amended complaint, as the other Justice Bradley points out. So that's number one. Number two is, Mr. McLeod stated in the oral argument today, it is a critical piece of the analysis that the city issued separate permits for the separate faces of the sign. Well, there's a critical error in that argument, that being that that is not in the record. And I don't believe that is true. There is some discussion in the amicus brief from the association regarding some law that the association says would allow the city to do that. But there's nothing in the record to indicate the city has actually treated the billboard that way, and I don't believe that the city has. So that is a critical problem. Also, Adams attempts to derive value from that argument, that permit argument, by alluding to the Maxey case, which is easily distinguishable from our case. Maxey was a permit case, first off, not a road development case like this one. Second, Maxey needed the permit to run the theater, to run the entire theater. Maybe Maxey would have more import to our case if Maxey had two screens and it needed a permit for one screen and a permit for the other, and the municipality denied it one of the permits. In that case, Maxey would have failed under the Zealy parcel as a whole analysis because there'd still be substantial value left in the theater. There'd be the other screen. So there's a number of problems with that permit argument. The taxation-type arguments raised in the amicus brief fail on the same grounds, and also because, let's face it, tax, licensure via permits, and takings law are three very distinct, very specialized areas of the law, all which have different standards, and terms mean different things. If we talk about whether this property is, whether the permit or whether the sign is real property for purposes of taxation, that doesn't make any difference for our analysis here. To decide this case in favor of Adams, this court would need to overrule its past precedent and make new law. A new law that would set Wisconsin apart as perhaps the only state in the country to allow a takings claim based upon obstruction of a view by a public works project.
I think it depends a little bit, Counselor, doesn't it, on how we set up the denominator, how we describe the article of property that has been taken, correct?
I missed the very start of that question.
Yeah, sorry. We have new mics, and I think they're a little bit better, but I probably wasn't speaking into it. I think it depends a little bit on how we define the denominator for this taking claim under Murr, where the denominator is how you describe the unit of property that's been taken, correct?
You are correct that the denominator is important under the second part of this analysis. There's always the threshold question at the outset as to whether this is a protected property right for purposes of the takings analysis. There's no dancing away from that, and I think that became clear during the first half of the oral argument today, if it had not in the briefs. Adams continues to argue that it's not the issue whether there is a right to be seen. At page 7 of its reply brief, Adams says the same thing. They say this case is not about a freestanding right to be seen. But it absolutely is. That's unavoidable. It is the threshold issue.
Well, you could also look at the cases, though, that talk about economic expectation. I mean, the property was bought, apparently, to be used for economic expectations, and those economic expectations involved at the time, a use that was conforming, and then subsequently a use that became non conforming. So haven't we in the past protected reasonable economic expectations?
Your Honor, you are correct that reasonable expectations do matter. So let's look at that in this specific context.
Okay.
An alleged right to be viewed impaired by a public's work project. That is exactly what the court dealt with in Randall. The court analyzed that issue and held that the plaintiff's interest in the visibility of their project, the plaintiff's interest in the visibility of their property was subject to, open quote, such public street use and purpose as the location of the street requires, close quote, and went on to hold that the loss of that interest was not compensable.
Well,
so
counsel,
I do
counsel,
agree.
Counsel, Mr. McLeod made the distinction that that dealt with prospective potential use, right? And this deals with an actual existing use. Doesn't that have some impact on the analysis? If you're not currently using the property in a particular manner, then you don't really have a current vested investment-backed expectation in that circumstance, do you?
Justice Kelly, that is a distinction. It does not matter. If we look at the first part of the analysis, whether there's a protected property right, the extent to which the owner was using the property does not determine whether there is the existence of a certain right. I believe it would become relevant under the second part of the analysis, which is Zeeley analysis or the denominator, that part of it. Yeah.
So let me just push back on that a little bit. In the zoning context, we say that there's a difference in whether you have a vested property right to a current zoning classification, and the linchpin is, did you apply for a building permit? And before you apply for that building permit, you don't have a vested property interest. After you apply for it, you do have a vested property interest, right? So property can come into existence simply by your use in a particular way, right? That's part of how we define property rights, is what are you doing with your property?
I would still assert, Your Honor, that you cannot create a right to be viewed just by profiting from being viewed. And especially, I think that's especially true in this context when you look at whether there's a right to be viewed from the public roadway.
Okay, so let's look at it.
Right to rental income? Isn't that a potential right here?
Your Honor, in the context of a takings case, income is not the measure of damages. We're talking about a value of property taken, if there was value.
But what about the deprivation of all economically beneficial or productive use of the property?
You're absolutely correct. That's part two of the analysis. And when we go there, we look at this property that Adams bought back in 2007 for $200,000. Now its own appraiser, after the construction of the Cannonball Bridge, tells us that property is worth $720,000.
But it was worth $1.4 million before the bridge was built, right?
That I don't believe that's explicitly in the record. It doesn't.
It's in the appendix.
If that is, I'll just go with that fact as you propose, Justice. Assuming that's true and that makes some sense. I know the west-facing panel is a cross-read, whereas the east-facing panel is a direct read for traffic, but it's two sides of the same sign. So let's assume that we have a sign and half of it's blocked. Well, there's still substantial economic value in that sign and in the property in general.
So there is a separate license for each of the signs, west-facing and east-facing. Is it a logical presumption that the west-facing sign lost 100% of its value since the appraiser appraised the property after the bridge was built at half of the value it had before the bridge was built?
Assuming if that were in the record, if there were separate licenses issued for the two separate sides of the sign, you would still need to look at the parcel as a whole. That is the ruling in Zeeley, and that's Penn Central. That's a wealth of just immense weight from the federal United States Supreme Court.
Counsel for Adams is citing to a Madison ordinance that appears to require a license for each sign. Can you speak to that ordinance?
Not specifically. I will agree they need to have a license to operate their sign. The license has to allow for use of advertising on both sides if they're going to use both sides. But that doesn't mean that we sever the two sides as separate property interests for purposes of the takings analysis. There is many elements of property in all sorts of contexts that could be split up, and they various elements of the property have value, but that doesn't mean that they are distinct, and especially doesn't mean that they should be distinct for purposes of the takings analysis. The United States Supreme Court has made absolutely clear repeatedly, hearkening back to Penn Central, by saying we've got to look at the parcel as a whole. We repeatedly refuse to segment individual parcels for purposes of the takings
but
analysis.
But your argument assumes the denominator is the parcel as a whole. That's what your argument assumes. That's not what Muir tells us we have to do. It says that it's critical how we define the denominator. You are defining it as the parcel as a whole, and that's how your brief defined it. And that's one way of doing it, but that isn't the only way of defining it, correct?
It is. If we're talking about multiple adjacent parcels, as the United States Supreme Court was dealing with in Muir,
right.
That is a different animal. But we've got to take a step back and look at what the court actually took on, what the United States Supreme Court took on in the Muir case. The court granted cert on a single question in that case. That question was, in a regulatory taking case, does the parcel as a whole concept, as described in Penn Central, establish a rule that two legally distinct but commonly owned contiguous parcels must be combined for the takings analysis purposes? I cannot stress that point enough. The Supreme Court fashioned the Muir test to resolve that particular question. Muir was a case about defining the circumstances under which the government could lump multiple adjacent parcels together for purposes of the analysis. Those were parcels that were treated under Wisconsin law as a single, they were two distinct parcels, but they couldn't be sold separately. That is a big difference. And we also have to consider the motivation of the court in Muir. The Supreme Court said that the decision and the development of those factors was motivated by a concern that states might manipulate their laws to consolidate parcels together, thus making it more difficult for property owners to obtain compensation for takings. That rationale, that concern, does not apply to our case. Adams has a single parcel, and Adams wants to split it up solely to manipulate the takings analysis.
See, what I am concerned with is you want to look at the parcel of real estate on which the signs sit. And I agree, I understand your argument, and I think you phrase it well in your written materials. What I'm trying to grapple with is opposing counsel's argument, and is it rational to look at the permit as an item of real property that puts out a reasonable expectation of income that was there, and it was also sanctioned by the city as a non-conforming use? They're all stuck together in my mind, and if you could help me separate them out, that would be fine. But I see you folks as kind of talking past each other. Do you know what I mean? Your argument is well taken, and I'm trying to fit it with what opposing counsel is saying. And to me, you don't bump into each other. You're going on parallel tracks because you're looking at a different denominator, and then all your arguments spring from that different foundation. Does that make sense to you?
It does. Okay. I appreciate your question. It is loaded up with several issues, so I'll try my best.
Okay.
I may not be able to address all of them if I'm redirected or if I forget. So, first off, you spoke somewhat about whether there are reasonable expectations to continue this use.
Right, right.
Randall tells us there's not. what there is a reasonable expectation of for a landowner that abuts a public highway or a public street is that over time, that public street may change. That Randall explicitly tells us that. Randall says lands set aside for public streets and highways, they are set aside not for the present with the necessities and modes of use, but for all time, and tells us that roadways are expected to keep up with the march of civilization, with the growth of population, and the consequent increase of travel so as to adequately satisfy public needs and conveniences as those develop over time. The insertion of a pedestrian bike path is exactly something that someone should expect to happen on a public roadway.
Particularly in Madison.
Well, these are all public uses, and it...
No, I don't think anybody's complaining that the city shouldn't have built the bridge, that it was not a valid public purpose. I don't think anybody's arguing that.
And just to address that directly, Randall does say the dedication of a highway is all-inclusive, including mm-hmm. all modes of travel. And Randall did explicitly deal with a pedestrian shelter and a pedestrian walkway that was to be used in conjunction with a pedestrian tunnel. So we're really talking about an underground tunnel and an above-ground tunnel or a bridge.
Well, this is a public improvement that obviously benefits many, many people, as public improvements are supposed to do. But isn't it leaning more heavily on Adams than anybody else in the public? It doesn't bother me that it's there, and if I were biking or walking across the Beltline, I would, of course, want to have this kind of a mode of getting from one side to the other. But I bear no burden for what was done here. It seems to me Adams is bearing quite a big burden.
I agree with you. I think that it has impacted Adams. I'm not jumping up and down to saying that's a great thing. I think it's fine that Adams can use their property consistent with the law to try to derive a profit. I have no qualm with that. I will note, in Randall, this Supreme Court cited to Sears v. Crocker, another pedestrian tunnel case, and it adopted the following quote from that case: "Our system, which leaves the landowner the use of the street above or below the surface, so far as he can use it without interference with the rights of the public, is just and right. But the public rights in these lands are plainly paramount, and they include, as they ought to include, the power to appropriate the streets above or below the surface, as well as upon it, in any way that is not unreasonable." That was the case in Randall, and that is exactly what we have in this case.
Counsel, at page 32 of your brief, you say Adams' argument regarding the nonconforming use of the sign is similarly unpersuasive. The city did not enact a new ordinance to retroactively impair Adams' ability to display its advertising sign along the Beltline. What if the city had enacted an ordinance that retroactively impaired the ability to display? Let's say the city enacts an ordinance that says, Adams, you will no longer display advertising on the west-facing aspect of the sign. Would that be a taking?
I don't believe it would. Obviously, that's not the case here, and the court doesn't need to go there to resolve this case. But no, I don't think it does for some of the same reasons that this case fails. You look at the two elements. There's still no right to be viewed. And the second component is still equally persuasive in the city's favor, that being, in this imaginary case, if there's no display moving forward on that certain panel, while there's still very substantial value remaining in the sign and in the property.
Is it that it's not a taking because of the denominator question or because there's no property right involved?
In this hypothetical scenario, I think it is not a taking for both reasons.
Okay. Let's say the city enacted a retroactive ordinance that said you must take down your signs entirely. Takings issue?
I don't believe that would be a takings. I know that other courts around the country have grappled with that situation, and commonly it's referred to as amortization type cases. The prevailing view among the courts is that in those situations there is no taking.
And in that circumstance, is there any remaining conceivable economic use of that property?
In this case?
Yes.
Absolutely. Adams still has the other panel of its sign and continues to profit from it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I changed up the hypothetical. So now the city says no sign at all. Take it down. Any remaining economic use of the property?
Your Honor, are you referring to taking down the entire sign, both panels?
Yes.
In that case, I think we'd have a much, much tougher case to deal with on the denominator issue. Absolutely.
Yeah. Would you, but does that conclusively decide the property interest issue?
As to that first segment of the analysis, whether there's a right to be viewed, that would be a more compelling fact scenario, but the law is still the same. There is no right to be viewed.
Okay. So currently they have a legal nonconforming use to have the billboards there. If the city told them to remove the billboard entirely, both faces, the pedestal, everything, is it your position that they have had no property rights interfered with?
Yes. Legal nonconforming use is just another form of legal use. It does not clothe Adams with additional rights or powers.
Okay. So let's say it's not a legal nonconforming use. It's just a legal use. And you've got a billboard that is making $1.4 million a year. The city comes along and says you must remove that. Is it your position you've not interfered with any property right?
You have affected their interest. You've affected them in a practical way. For a takings analysis, absolutely, it is not a taking. That's the holding of Randall. The public's right to development of these public roadways is plainly paramount. That's been made clear.
Yeah, okay. I'm not talking about the roadway yet. I'm just saying, let's say this has nothing to do with the roadway at all. City just decides, we don't want billboards anymore, right? And so it issues an ordinance that tells everybody in the city who has a billboard to take them down. Has the city interfered with a property right?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I still don't believe there is a right to be viewed. But I do want to point out that the sort of where our dialogue has taken us here is very illustrative for the case at hand. That being that the city's position is much, I think, more compelling in this case than it would be in your hypothetical situation because of the fact that this is a public roadway and reasonable development of the public roadways on public land is to be expected, and the public's rights in those ways are plainly paramount and superior to any interest that Adams may or may not have to be seen.
Well, that its interest in developing the roadways clearly is superior, but that doesn't mean it can do it at the expense of private property owners, right? I mean, those are two different concepts. What we're trying to figure out is whether there's a property right first. And it apparently is the city's position that there is no property right in billboards. Yes?
That is the city's position. That is one of the reasons to affirm the grant of summary judgment. I will refer the court to the RW Docs decision of this case, where the court discussed the riparian rights of an owner, that being the rights of an owner abutting a lake to access and use the lake, and talked about how those rights were in, and this was a takings case, and talked about how those rights were inferior to the public's right over that lake. And so it is, especially when we think about what Randall has already told us about the paramount nature of the public rights in roadways, it is an instructive analogy, and I think that the two decisions are consistent in that way.
Council,
please go.
Wouldn't the city concede that you've at least, at a minimum, taken one stick in the bundle, if you will, on this parcel, if we view the parcel as the property?
Your Honor, that I would say that it is a stick in the bundle, and that is sort of exactly my point on the on the Zealy part of the analysis. And I'd refer this court to the United States Supreme Court in a decision in Andrews v. Allard, a 1979 case, Where an owner possesses a full bundle of property rights, the destruction of one strand of the bundle is not a taking, because the aggregate must be viewed in its entirety. That's still the law for the United States and for Wisconsin.
I just wanted to clarify, because maybe I was misunderstanding you, but I heard you to say that there was no property taken, and I don't mean in a takings context, but there was no property impaired even here, but there was at least a stick taken.
Well, I appreciate the follow-up, because that's an important point. I acknowledge the obvious, that building this bridge had a practical impact on Adams. But your question is very helpful, because it's important to draw the distinction between what may impair an interest or a benefit on one hand, but then on the other hand, whether it's a protected property right for purposes of takings analysis. So I appreciate that, and that takes me back to Justice Kelly's question. And that dialogue that we had. It's not a protected property right for purposes of the takings analysis.
I would like to go, and I think you're finished now, Rebecca. I'd like to go with that threshold question. As I hear some of the questions, I hear your answers. I want to make sure that I understand your framework of analysis, and it's this. I think you start out that with the argument that this is not a recognized property right. The right to have a sign not obstructed is not a recognized property right for which there can be a taken, neither recognized in Wisconsin or anywhere else. End of analysis. That's how I understood your briefing. But because if it's not a recognized property right, you don't get to the other more sophisticated, or other questions, rather. But if it is a recognized property right, then you get into Zeeley, more particularly, you get into the Murr analysis. And Murr has three prongs. As I understand it, the third prong of the Murr analysis, this deals with the denominator test and how to decide whether or not there's a taking, the third prong deals with the burden on the property owner, the value lost, etc. Would you go through your analysis? Let's assume the court does not agree with you, and the court says, no, this is a recognized property right in this state or elsewhere, and so then we have to go to the next step of analysis. So go through the three Murr steps, if you will, and apply them here.
Your Honor, I'm happy to do that. I want to note, just to be very clear, I think that if we get to the second part of the analysis, to the Zeeley analysis, that does not take us to the Murr factors. I do not believe that the United States Supreme Court, in light of the immense weight of legal authority from the U.S. Supreme Court over the years, we're talking bedrock core principle cases, Keystone Coal, Tahoe Sierra, all of these cases talking about the parcel as a whole theory. And then for the court in Murr to cite those cases.
I appreciate that. So you're saying the threshold question, is this a protectable interest? Second, then, in your framework of analysis is the Zeeley Penn Central stuff, right?
Yes.
And then you get to Murr. Is that the framework of your analysis? Or don't you?
For the sake of argument, yes, I get to Murr.
For the sake of argument, if you lose on your threshold, if you lose on Zeeley and Penn Central, then you have an argument on Murr. That's your framework, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, then tell me your
framework. So, factor one, treatment of the land under state law, how is it bounded or divided? That factor weighs heavily in favor of the city's position. This is not like Murr, where we had two adjacent parcels that got intermingled through a very complex series of developments over decades. This is a parcel that Adams bought as one parcel. It's still one parcel. A parcel is the most natural way to think about a physical plot of land. All right, so first factor, I think, weighs heavily in favor of Murr and also in favor of the city's position. And I also want to point out, in talking about the first factor, Murr says, let's look at the reasonable expectations of the property owner. And that takes me back to all of the arguments in Randall and all of the law in Randall. I won't spend time on that here. Second factor, physical characteristics of the landowner's property. In Murr, the odd-shaped nature of the property, rough terrain of the property, the fact that those facts, rough terrain, narrow shape, promoted singularity of use, meaning it could just be used for one use. And Murr said that weighed heavily in favor of aggregation of two parcels, not splitting them up. So that's the second factor. The third factor, I think, really does not translate well because it's talking about taking effect on one parcel and comparing it with another parcel. And Adams even concedes that in its brief, that that factor doesn't translate well. That supports my argument that Murr does not apply to a splitting case like this one. But if we're forced to go down that road, Murr does talk about whether the,
Council,
it can be... Go ahead.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Sorry.
Because there's a red light, and I have read your briefs. I was most interested in the framework of your analysis. You don't get to question two unless you have question one against you. You don't get to question three, and then you have the three elements of Murr. Thank you.
I appreciate that. May I make one point that I think it has not been addressed at all and I think is very important to clarify?
Do it briefly, please.
Yes. There was a stipulation in the record regarding obstruction of the west-facing panel. Adams has argued that if this case is remanded, that it should be remanded for a determination of damages only. I strongly disagree with that. That stipulation was for purposes of the city's motion for summary judgment only. So if this case were to be remanded, it should be on all remaining issues, including the extent of the obstruction.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think it's critical that we understand specifically what the exercise is as a threshold matter. And there was some confusion, I think, on the part of the city's argument concerning the sequence of that analysis. The question of what the denominator is part and parcel of the question of whether there is a protectable property interest. If we determine that the property interest at issue here that is protectable is the whole parcel, that's the denominator. The numerator, which is the impact on the west-facing panel, has a different calculation than if we determine that the denominator, the interest, protectable interest in property, is the west-facing panel, in which case, if the west-facing panel is the denominator, that's the protectable legal interest that the court identifies, 100% of that interest has been taken, and it's a taking. The parcel as a whole, the whole parcel analysis does not apply in circumstances where there is a pre-existing use, because the question is not what I may use the property for in the future for purposes of defining the denominator. It's what am I using the property for today? And contrary to what has been suggested, Murr is not an aggregation claim, because in any case where you're talking about how you define the denominator, what is the legally protectable property interest, you're going to aggregate or disaggregate one way or the other depending on the facts and circumstances of the case. And Murr, while in that case it was a question of whether two parcels should be aggregated, in this case the city itself has disaggregated, in its briefing at least, which is their position has been that the billboard is the property interest, and they've only taken half of that interest, and therefore there's no legally compensable taking. They've disaggregated from the parcel, which includes the piece of land upon which this billboard sits, down to the billboard. So they've already done a disaggregation analysis. They just simply are unwilling to go to the appropriate lengths of disaggregation that the facts and the legal doctrines that underlie the vested property rights demand. Murr is all about defining the denominator, the legally protectable property interest. There are not two separate questions there, because Murr says we should look at what is alleged to be the protectable property interest, and I think it's pretty well established what we have alleged. Our property interest is in our ability to maintain and display advertising and generate revenue from the west-facing panel. However we slice that and define it, but the west-facing panel is our denominator.
Counsel, in your original argument, you referenced Prawl versus Moretti for the principle that you would have a private nuisance cause of action against a private party who had constructed something that would block access to the billboard, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The private nuisance, of course, is a tort, but is it based on an interference with a property right or something else?
It is, in fact, interference with a property right, and that is the right to use and enjoyment of one's own property. And when somebody engages in activity on adjacent property that impairs or destroys my ability to make use of my property rights on my property, that's where we recognize the tort of private nuisance. We don't have a constitutional claim for taking in a private party context for obvious reasons, but the law under those circumstances provides a remedy to the property owner to protect his or her interests in the use and enjoyment of that property.
So is it your position that Prawl versus Moretti, if we look at this case through that lens, that helps us define what a property right is with respect to the billboards?
I don't think it's necessary to consider Prawl for purposes of this case and the analysis as to whether or not there's been a taking here. The Prawl analysis arises in the context of a different case.
Sure.
But underneath Prawl,
you don't even cite Prawl. Prawl isn't cited.
We did not cite Prawl. But the question that is not presented here is what is the nature of the claim in the context of private action on adjacent property as opposed to government action. But the underlying legal principle is the same, Your Honor, which is my constitutionally protected private property interests to make use of my property in a particular manner. How that manifests itself and what the facts and circumstances are in a particular case are always going to be dependent upon that particular case. And this court need not pronounce that there is any right to be seen or a right to a view. That is not a legal principle that is implicated here. The legal principle is, and I see that my red light is on, I'm just going to finish the sentence.
Quickly.
The legal principle is whether or not a pre-existing legal nonconforming use can be protected from government action. We're not dealing with a case. Penn Central is prospective development. Zealy is prospective development. Randall is prospective development. Every one of those cases.
Except for Andrus, which was different. The U.S. Supreme Court case in Andrus wasn't prospective. It was pre-existing.
But different circumstances, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you for very good arguments. This is a really, really interesting case. The briefs were very good. I read one and I think, oh, that must be correct. And then I read the other one and I think, oh, no, maybe we have something really to talk about at oral argument. So thank you both. The briefs were excellent and so was the argument. We're going to adjourn now and we'll be back for our third case at 1:30. Justice Shirley Abrahamson will be out to talk to the students and whoever else wishes to remain in just a couple of minutes. We are adjourned.